Awesome. So excited for you guys to be here tonight. My name is Rob Shepherd. I'm the lead pastor at Next Level. And I'm excited that you're here for a couple reasons. Number one, the weather is awful outside. And so the fact that you came to church on a Sunday night, I believe it means that God's going to bless your children's children for 1,000 generations. So thank you for being here tonight. And number two, I'm really excited that you're here tonight because we're kicking off a brand new series entitled The Greatest Gift. And I don't know if there are any Christmas enthusiasts in here. Anyone love Christmas? Yeah. All right. I love Christmas. I think that this is the most wonderful time of the year. I love everything about Christmas, and I really do love Christmas gifts. I get amped about Christmas gifts. I am 35 years old, and still to date, every Christmas Eve, I cannot sleep with the anticipation of Christmas gifts. And most of my gifts now are gift cards. They're not even worth getting excited about, but I just can't help it. I love Christmas. And I thought it would be fun to kick off this series entitled The Greatest Gift with going back in time and looking at some of the greatest gifts that have ever been given in decades past. And here's what we're going to do. I'm going to show you a picture on the screen. And if you know what this great gift is, and these gifts were like the must-have items of the Christmas season. If you know what it is, just shout out the name and we'll have a little fun with these greatest gifts. We're going to start with the 1930s. The 1930s, some of you remember this. What is that? That was a given because it's actually on the product. So even if you weren't around in the 1930s, you should be able to read. The ViewMaster. This was a game changer. And you got to remember, back in the day, they didn't have iPods and iPads. You went on a car trip. This saved your life. That was an amazing, amazing gift. The ViewMaster. All right, we're going to jump a decade to the must-have gift of the 1940s. What's that? Silly Putty. I love Silly Putty. I keep Silly Putty on me, at least at my house, all the time. I always have Silly Putty. It's always in my office. I love Silly Putty. If you ever tried to do that and actually put it on a newspaper, it will read the paper for you, but it ruins your Silly Putty, and it makes your hands all black. It was awful to do. I don't recommend doing that if you like playing with Silly Putty. All right, we're going to jump to the 1950s. Barbie. This was a game changer in the toy department. Our Barbie today looks a lot different than that Barbie, but that was a absolute game changer. The 1960s got a little violent. They introduced us. Rock'em Sock'em Robots. That was an amazing gift for like 5 minutes, and then it was just like, oh, I'm done with that game. But that was incredible back in the 1960s. All right, the 1970s was a fun decade. Pong. Okay, now, okay, only about four of you answered that one. So I want, this is a significant, we need to take a moment to reflect on the amazingness of Pong. Without Pong, we would not have things like PlayStations and Xboxes. And in the 70s, this, you could get this, and I wasn't really alive, but I believe that the first Pong game, it just came with Pong. That was it. And then they had one for Atari that you could play other games on your Atari, but the first system was just Pong. And Pong was like ping pong, but a video game, and you just move the little things up, boop, 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 like awesome. I mean, this was a game changer. This was an amazing gift. It may look lame to you, but it was an amazing gift. All right, now we're going to jump to the 1980s, which I think is the greatest decade in the history of decades. It produced the best movies, the best music, and the best must-have gifts of any decade. And the must-have gift of the 80s was Teddy Ruxpin. This was a game changer. If you don't remember Teddy Ruxpin, this blew our minds. This was a toy that could talk, and he would not just talk, he would read a story along as you could read, like, look at the story. His mouth would move, and he would read the story. Now, I never did this, but some of my friends swore that you could actually put AC/DC tapes in Teddy Ruxpin, and he would sing AC/DC. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I heard. Teddy Ruxpin was a game changer. Now, here's the thing. The 80s were such a great decade that I cannot just show you one gift. I need to show you two. And this next gift is my personal favorite toy from the 1980s. All right. Now, it's not just G.I. Joe. Does anyone know who that is? Snake Eyes. Okay. If you did not answer that, I want you to leave this moment and go home and repent of your sins. Because that, no, I'm joking. That was a game changer for me. Snake eyes was really hard to find. I actually had to trade someone to get my snake eyes. I had to trade them like three G.I. Joes to actually get a copy of Snake Eyes. He was very hard to find. He came with a wolf. He was amazing. I loved Snake Eyes. Now we're going to jump to the 1990s. A lot of you remember the 1990s. This was the must-have gift of Christmas. Tickle Me Elmo. Tickle Me Elmo. If you remember the 1990s and when Tickle Me Elmo came out, there were lines like wrapped around the store trying to get a Tickle Me Elmo. It was crazy that people wanted this annoying toy that would fall down and laugh and act like you were tickling. But those were some of the must-have gifts. And I don't know if you guys thought that was fun or not, but I love going down memory lane. I love looking at these gifts, and it floods me with all sorts of memories. Like, I just remember being a kid and running downstairs and like just having like a burst of excitement. Like, I just thought I was going to explode if I could not open the gifts right away. And you would start to open it, and there'd been something that you'd asked for months in advance, and you're hoping it's under the tree. And like, I don't know your family's tradition. My family, we had to wait. Like, we'd open one gift at a time and go around the circle, and I would like try to pick the gift that I thought was the must-have item. And if it wasn't it, I was like, okay, let's hurry up, get around the circle. I got to get to this toy. And it brings all this like excitement, and I love it. It brings some memories. The weird thing is, though, even though in my life I've had most of those toys that were featured, and even though in my life those toys brought a lot of excitement and joy, I no longer have those toys, and those toys no longer bring the same excitement or joy to my life that they once did. It's really interesting to me that you can have something in your life that brings so much excitement, it keeps you up at night. Once you get it, you're just filled with joy, and you were so excited about this Christmas gift that what did you do? You ran out and you told all your friends, I got it. I got the Barbie. I got G.I. Joe. You're inviting your friends over. At least that's what I did. And every few years, Christmas would land on a Sunday. And I know that being a pastor, you would probably think that I would love that. But as a kid, I hated it. I hated having to go to church on Christmas. I was like, why are you competing with my Christmas, Jesus? What's going on? I just want to open presents. Awful kid. I know. But there was one highlight to going to church on Christmas. You could share with all your friends the amazing gifts that you got. But how come we're not still excited about the ViewMaster and the Tickle Me Elmo and the G.I. Joe? How come we've lost something? In fact, most of those toys, they gave you excitement for probably just a few weeks. Some of you, maybe it was a few months, but by 6 months away from Christmas, that toy most likely went from being something that filled your life with so much joy that you ended up putting it on a shelf and it just collected dust and you forgot to play with it. Why is that? If you ever own a bicycle, I know you experience this. When you get that bike on Christmas, it's like so amazing and you take such great care of it. And when you're done riding a bike, what do? You step off of it gently and you actually put down the kickstand and you love the bike and it's shining. 3 months after owning a bike, how do you park that thing? You jump off of it while it's still rolling and let it just crash into the garage, and you don't even care. Why? It's lost its luster. It's lost that sparkle. It's lost that joy. Something that once brought so much excitement and joy to you now is just collecting dust. And for most of us, not just collecting dust, eventually we just got rid of it like it didn't mean anything to us at all. I can't help but think about those same feelings when it comes to the modern church today and Jesus. And if you're here today and you're a guest, and maybe this is your first time at church in a long time, or you're new to this church scene, I want you to know that we are not perfect. And in fact, what I'm about to say is a reflection of how imperfect us Christians are. If you did grow up in the church, or maybe if you've been a Christian for a while, I'm guessing that you've experienced this. It was like Christmas morning when you got Jesus, and it was so exciting, and it was so awesome, and you couldn't wait to tell people about it. And it was like, this is a game changer. This is so amazing. But then what happens? The longer you're a Christian, those warm fuzzies kind of start to fade. And all of a sudden, this thing that brought so much joy to you, you've kind of used it up like it was a Tickle Me Elmo, and now Jesus kind of sits up on the shelf somewhere, and you would still say, yep, I love Jesus. He's still a part of my life. You're here, right? You're at church on an awful weather night. That's incredible. But the question is Jesus bringing that same joy and that same excitement and that same passion in your life? Because if he's not, it's not that he's changed. Something else has happened. And I would say that for the vast majority of Christians that go to church on a regular basis, that joy and that passion has diminished. And they've gone from at one point in their life from saying, I love Jesus, yes I do. I love Jesus, how about you? To saying, yeah, I love Jesus. Eh. I think for far too many of us, Jesus has become something that's kind of set on the shelf. And every once in a while we think about him. Every once in a while we have a memory of how great it used to be. But there's not this excitement. There's not this driving passion. And I think the main way that we can tell this is because in the modern church today, there are awful stats that point to the fact that churched people, people that would say that they are a Christian, do not tell their unchurched friends about God. And I think that that plays into it because everything in my life that I've ever enjoyed, that I've ever been passionate about, that I've ever loved, I couldn't help telling other people about it. And so if Jesus is a part of my life and he's not on the shelf, if he's really exciting and he's a part of my life, there should be something inside of me that is going out and telling other people, you've got to experience what I have. Because here's the deal. I'm not just telling you this as a pastor. I really do think that Jesus is a game changer. I think Jesus is the answer to your problem. I think Jesus gives us more joy than anything else in this world. I think he is a better experience than any party, any Christmas gift, any high. I think Jesus is awesome. I think Jesus is amazing. He is cool. One day maybe at church, everyone will clap for that, but we're working on it. We're a work in progress. I really do. I think Jesus is amazing. I think he is a game changer. He changes everything. And yet, I read a recent article from Lifeway Christian Research. And Lifeway Christian Research found that 80% of those who attend church one or more times a month believe they have a personal responsibility to share their faith. But 61% have not told another person about how to become a Christian in the previous 6 months. So that means 80% of people feel like that Jesus is awesome, that he's worth sharing, that he could change someone's life. 80%. That's an incredible number. But then 61% have said, yep, he's awesome, but I'm just not going to share him with anyone. 61%. The stats went on to ask how many of those people have actually invited someone to attend church with them. Nearly half, 48% of church attendees responded zero. So 48% of the people surveyed said in the last 6 months, they've invited zero people to their church. Zero. Now, the stats go on. They get a little worse. It says 33% of people say they've personally invited someone one or two times. So 33% have actually invited someone. But this was interesting. 19% say that they've only invited three people in the last 6 months. So 19% have invited three people. So the vast majority of people that would say, I love Jesus, yes I do, would end up saying, I love Jesus, but I don't care about you. 19% have only invited someone to their church, three people, in the last 6 months. And I can't help but wonder if that's not because that we don't like Jesus. I can't help but wonder if that's because we've lost that passion, that excitement for Jesus. Because every time you get something new, you post it on Facebook, you tell your friends, there's an excitement. So how come there's not that same excitement about the living God who sent his son to die for us? How come we have to be reminded to share our faith? I think it's because we've placed Jesus up on a shelf somewhere and we've said, yep, I've got Jesus. But we forgot about the impact of it. And we forgot about how much he can actually change other people's lives. Luckily for us, this is not something that just the modern church has struggled with. This is something that Jesus' followers in Jesus' day, it's something that they struggled with. And in Jesus' day, he gave a sermon, which many people think is the greatest sermon ever. It is called the Sermon on the Mount. And it is creatively titled the Sermon on the Mount because Jesus preached a sermon on a mount. Okay, I don't know if you're tracking with this, but the Sermon on the Mount is called the Sermon on the Mount. On the Mount. And this is an amazing sermon where Jesus teaches a group of people that would say, I love Jesus. Yes, I do. They would say, I've signed up on the dotted line. I am a Christian. And he tells them a whole bunch of things about what it means to follow God. And in that sermon, he addresses this same thing that so many of us struggle with. Look at what Jesus had to say to those that were there that day. He said, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot." So Jesus said, hey, you are the salt of the earth. Who is the you? It's those who have came on the mountainside that would say, I believe in you, Jesus. I'm here saying that I'm a follower of you. I'm a disciple. So if you're here today and you're just checking out the church thing, if you're not a Christian yet, guess what? You have a free pass today. This isn't telling you what to do. You can just sit and check it out and zone out if you want to. You can even get on Twitter for all I care. This is something for you just to enjoy and just say, hey, this is what it means. This is what Christians are supposed to do. But if you're here today and you would say, yep, I am a Christian. I sign on the dotted line. This is Jesus is speaking to you. And he says that you are the salt of the earth. Okay, so now we need to ask ourselves, what did Jesus mean by that? Because Jesus doesn't give an explanation. He doesn't say, you are the salt of the earth. Now let me break that down. This is what it means. He just says, you're the salt of the earth. And I don't think he gave an explanation because everyone in his audience nodded their head and said, I get that. That makes sense to me. Jesus used an everyday common object that they all were like, yep, I understand what salt did. But Jesus was around 2,000 years ago, so salt may have had some different features than salt today. Thankfully, we have really smart people and historians who actually researched some things, and according to Wikipedia, salt in Jesus' day had two functions. Number one, salt was used to preserve food. Salt was used to preserve food. Now, you got to picture this. In Jesus' day, they didn't have refrigerators. So when Jesus went out to a restaurant to eat with his friends, and they had too much food, and they had to take it home, and they put it in a little container, and they took it home, when they walked home, they didn't have a cold place to put it. So what did they do? They covered it in salt, hoping that it would preserve the leftovers for another day or two. Or their food, when they would kill an animal, they would just salt the mess out of it to preserve it, to keep it, so they could eat it more than just that night. That was one of the features. So when Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth, everyone would have nodded their head because they would have understood that salt was used to preserve food. There was a second feature of salt, and this is one we can relate to. Salt was used as a flavor enhancer. This is how we use salt. We don't have to salt the mess out of our leftovers. We just put it in the fridge. But if we have something that doesn't taste good, what do? Put some salt on it. Now, I don't know if maybe you guys don't use salt, but there are multiple times in my life where I've been served vegetables, and after one taste, my head kind of turns to the side, and I go, and it's like, okay, I've got to choke down the rest of these vegetables. What do? Give me the salt. And you pour some salt on it, and then it tastes better, right? That's why we use salt, is a flavor enhancer. So in Jesus' day, they would have nodded their head and said, yep, it preserves food, and it enhances the flavor of food. So I think it is safe to say that when Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth, this is what he meant. Number one, you are to get the most out of this world. You are to get the most out of this world. You are the salt of the earth. That is, you are called to preserve the earth. You are called to get the most out of creation. Now, let's talk about what that means specifically. God has given every single human amazing gifts. Even if you don't believe in God, you can experience the goodness of God. For example, creation. You don't have to believe in God to experience how amazing creation is. You see a sunset and it just does something to you. But if you're here and you would say, I'm a Christian, a sunset takes on a whole new meaning. Because when you look at a sunset, it's not just like, oh, that's cool. It's like, oh my God, you are an amazing artist. And you did that sunset for me. This is amazing. And you look at creation and you get the most out of it. Way more than anyone that doesn't believe in God. Or what about happiness? God gives happiness. Even people who would say, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God. God gives happiness. You can experience happiness and not believe in God. But for the Christian, it's not just that we get happiness, we get joy. And there is joy in Jesus, and joy is happiness on steroids. It is a way greater experience than happiness. Because happiness leaves depending on your circumstances. Joy is something that is deep down inside, that it rises up inside of you, even when life stinks. Jesus is so amazing that he changes everything. And you can be going through a difficult time. And even if you're a Christian today, you're going to go through a difficult time. But God gives you joy. And so we should be preserving. We should be showing the world, this is how you really live. I'm getting the most out of this world. People should not look to the party scene to have a great experience. They should be looking to the church. And if they want to have a good time, they shouldn't be looking to a substance. They should be looking to Christians. We should understand how this world lives, and we should be preserving it. We should be making it better. We should be saying, hey, this is how this thing really goes down. Included in that, I think Christians are called to actually take care of the earth. Far too many Christians think, okay, my place is in heaven one day when I die, and so we think we can just use and abuse this earth. But I think you're called to be the salt, and that means that you are called to leave earth better than the way that you found it. You're called to be the salt. So I think that means you're called to get the most out of this world. Number two, I think it means that you're supposed to help people experience the goodness of God. Salt was a preserver, but it also was a flavor enhancer. So what does that mean? Well, that means that when someone hangs out with you, they should be able to experience the goodness of God. And the Bible is really clear that if you want to experience God, you've got to taste and see. Well, how do you taste God today? You taste God through the experience of one of his loved ones acting like a Christian. And when you're around them, you're just like, man, I can just taste God. I just smell God. I experience God when I'm around you. And a Christian should be so filled with God that their conversations are different. That everyone else is complaining, everyone else is going negative, but they're finding joy in this world. And they know how to have a good time because they're filled with this amazing, just inexplainable joy. And Christians should be so different than everyone else that when someone hangs out with you, they should say, oh my God, that was an amazing experience. We are to be the salt of the earth. And that is, we are to be the flavor enhancers. People should be able to really say, hey, I'm missing something. I've experienced some happiness, but I haven't experienced what that joker's experienced. What are you on? What are you doing? I love the way that the Message paraphrases this verse. If you're not familiar with the Message, I'll just explain something quickly to you. The Bible, the Old Testament of our Bible, was written in Hebrew, and the New Testament was written in Greek. And so when you have a Bible today and it's in English, that's not the way the Bible was written. Someone has looked at the Hebrew or the Greek, and they've said, okay, this means this word in their culture. What's the English equivalent? And they put it down, and they have the sentence structures. And so most Bibles try to stick with, okay, what were the exact wording of the verse, of the saying? The Message paraphrase says, we're not going to worry about the actual words in there. We're going to take the meaning of it and pull out the meaning and put it in a way that we can understand. And so I personally love the Message paraphrase. And this is what it says with that verse. It says, let me tell you why you are here. That is to say, your purpose in life. You're here to be salt seasoning that brings out the God flavors of this earth. I love that verse. I love that wording. The people should be able to hang out with you and say, man, life just tastes better with you. I've had a lot of great experiences, but with you, life is just better. You bring something to the table that I can't experience with anyone else. Why? Because you have experienced God. You are to bring out the God flavors of this earth. So when Jesus said that you are the salt of the earth, specifically what he was saying is that you are to go out into the world and to hang out with people that don't have the God flavors. You are to hang out with those that are unchurched, those that would say, I don't believe in God, those that would say, I used to believe in God, but I had a bad church experience, so I no longer believe in God. You are to go out and to give flavor to those that have not experienced the goodness of God. And we would say, in our modern terms, that that's what it means to make a disciple. Jesus, when he was getting ready to go back up into heaven, he looked out to his followers, his disciples, his 12, actually 11 closest followers at the time, and he tells them, I'm leaving, I'm going to heaven, but I'm leaving you this message. This is my challenge for you. You are to go into all the world and make disciples, baptizing them in my name and teaching them to obey everything that I've taught you. And this is why at Next Level Church, one of our core values is disciples, disciple. A core value is simply the structure. This is what we believe. This is what we're striving for. And one of our goals is that every person that would say, hey, Next Level is my church, would say, yep, it's my church and I am a disciple. I've said I'm going to follow Jesus. And because I said I'm going to follow Jesus, that means I'm going to be the salt of the earth and I'm going to go find other people that don't follow Jesus and I'm going to invest in them and I'm going to love them. And not because I'm going to make them a project, not because we have some goal to reach a million people, just because I love people and this is my purpose in life. I am called to go out to where there are not God flavors and to bring the flavor of God into this world. So that's what it means to be salt. But I want to look at this verse again because Jesus wasn't done. He didn't just say that you are the salt of the earth. He goes on to say something incredibly challenging. Look at it. He says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. So Jesus poses a great question. And the question is, if those that have the salt lose their saltiness, how can you make it salty again? That is to say, at one point you were passionate about God. At one point you told people about Him. At one point your conversations reflected Him. At one point someone was like, dude, what is going on with you? But now Jesus has kind of moved to a shelf and He's collected dust and no one's asking those questions anymore. So there's some saltiness that's left. There's no longer that same excitement. If you were around Tom Cruise in the 1980s, he might would have sung to you, you've lost that love and feeling. There's something missing. It's no longer there. It's gone. What used to be here is no longer here. You aren't salty anymore. Now, Jesus doesn't tell us what we do to lose that saltiness or why we lose that saltiness. But I have a theory. And my theory goes back to Jesus' challenge. He says that you are the salt of the earth. And I think that if we are not the salt of the earth, we end up losing that saltiness. We end up losing that loving feeling. We end up losing those warm fuzzies, that passion. When we don't obey God in this one area, eventually we use up God for everything we can get out of Him, and then we kind of turn on Him. And we just say, okay, I've got you. I got the warm fuzzies. I got my ticket to heaven. I'm good to go. And then we just sit there. And the excitement leaves and the passion goes away. Why? Because there's not something that is stirring inside of you to continue this passionate pursuit of God. And I personally believe that too much salt is bad for you. Here's what I mean by that. If you were a salt collector, you would want just a little bit inside of you. But as a Christian, how do we get salt? Well, we hang out with other Christians, we read our Bibles, we go to church, which is a great thing. I think you should go to church every single week. In fact, I believe that you have a 100% more chance of God moving in your life by going to church every week than if you skip all the time. I really do believe that. I don't know when God's going to show up and just do something amazing in our midst, but if you're not here, you might miss it. So I think it's a great thing to be at church every single week. And when you're at church, God speaks to you and He fills you and you start to get a little bit of God's presence and it's like you're having salt in you. But eventually, when you have a little bit of salt and you just keep piling it on and you're not pouring any of that salt out, you get to a point where you just reek. Have you ever had something that had too much salt on it? It's just, ugh, that's so gross. Way too much salt on this. I love salt, but man, you killed it. And there is a term, it's kind of a play on words. We are to have salt, but have you ever heard of the term, you're being salty? It's not a compliment. In fact, if you Google the definition of salty, it says things like, you are angered, you are bitter, you're mad at the world. So there's this idea that if you have God's salt inside of you, but you never share that with anyone else, you will just build up to get to the point where you no longer taste good. And Jesus actually addressed this, not in this sermon, but in a different sermon. He uses the same analogy, but He shows us what happens. I want to read this to you. It's going to come up on the screen. He says, salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can you make it salty again? Have salt among yourselves and be at peace with each other. So what is Jesus saying? Jesus is saying, hey, you should have salt amongst yourselves. You should be going out into the world and telling other people about me. You should be making disciples. And if you don't, guess what happens? You won't have peace with each other. In fact, you will turn on one another and you will start to go negative and tear each other down. Now, this is an amazing concept to me, and it makes a lot of sense because I've been in the church world since I was born, and I've been on church staff since I was 18 years old, and I've been in a lot of churches. I was on staff at a church that had over 3,000 people. I was on church staff at another church that had over 2,000 people. I've been on church at a staff that had 140 people on a good day. I've been on church staff at a little country church. I've been on church staff at a modern contemporary church. I was a member of a church in Texas that had over 20,000 people. It was one of the first multi-site churches in America. And the crazy thing is I've been a part of all these different churches, and they are all completely different. They all had different visions. They all had different pastors, different leadership. They all felt very different. But they all had one thing that was in common. And the one thing that was in common was that there was a group of people who would go negative, who would tear down what God was doing in the church, who would forget all the great things that God was doing and would nitpick at the little bad things that they didn't like. Now, why does that happen in even great churches? It is because those that are supposed to be pouring out salt have not done their job, and they've got so much salt inside of them, they just become ugly. They become the type of person that you just don't want to hang out with because they go negative. Now, I want you to know that I am preaching this not because I think that there is a lot of negativity at Next Level Church. Maybe there is, and maybe you guys are just protecting me, but I don't hear negativity. I don't get negative emails from you guys. I don't get negative tweets. No one comes up to me after the service and says, I hate you. Like, I get a very positive vibe from Next Level Church. In fact, most of the time when I go on Facebook, you guys are saying really complimentary things, that God's moving in your life, and people are saying, yeah, I really love the worship tonight. And most of you are just saying really encouraging things. And when I talk to most of you after the service, most of the time it's encouraging. And by the way, I get it. When you see the pastor, you feel like you have to give him a compliment. Don't give me a compliment if you don't really mean it. Okay, I get it. Just give me a high five and say, go get him, Tiger. But a lot of times, after the service, a lot of you say genuine things like, man, God really spoke to me through the word that you delivered tonight. So the vast majority of my interaction is positive. And I think it's positive because God is doing a lot of incredible things at Next Level Church. We're not a perfect church. We have our own issues, but there is some amazing things going on here. Including the fact we are, I don't know if you realize this, but we are only a year and a half old. A year and a half. And yet, there are other churches that will call us on somewhat of a regular basis and say, can you tell us how you do what you do? Now, have you ever been a part of anything that was only a year and a half old? Most things are not real great at a year and a half. But most people, when they visit Next Level Church, don't think that we're only a year and a half old. They think we're 8 years old, 9 years old. They think we've been doing this for a long time. We're rookies. We're a year and a half old. Not only are we only a year and a half old, we have a very slim staff. There are two full-time paid staff members, which I think is an incredible blessing to have. Me and Stephen Haggerty, our worship pastor. But then we also have two grossly underpaid staff members that it's an insult what we pay them, but they still work for almost free, and they work full-time. And then we have another staff member that's almost part-time staff member that gets paid nothing, so he just works for free. And there's five of us that help organize all the volunteers and oversee all the programs and help make sure Sundays go really well. That's not a lot of people. And only two of them are getting paid, and yet we still have people that will say, literally call us and say, can you teach us to do what you do? That's a God thing. That's not because we're awesome. That's because God is awesome. But there are lots of great things going on in our church. Every month, we strive to make a practical difference in the world. And we don't hype this up. We call it our Make a Difference. We don't try to convince you to go out and make a difference. We just simply say it in a 60-second update. It comes on the screen. This month, this is how we're helping. And every single month, you guys sign up and go out and make a difference in the world. That's incredible. Literally, there are other churches who say, how do you get your people to go out in the community and do all this stuff? This is crazy. I had a pastor call and ask me and say, hey, we can't get anyone to volunteer. How do you have so many volunteers? God is doing some great stuff in our church. Through you. I think it is a miracle to be a part of this church. In fact, last December, we got a letter that there was a need to help raise money for foreign missionaries. And that there are missionaries all around the world that are spreading the gospel. They are being salt. They are telling people about Jesus in areas where it is illegal to talk about Jesus. And they put their life on the line, and they don't have enough funding. And so we got this, and we said, hey, we can do something about that. Let's take up an offering. And then we had the idea, okay, what if this wasn't just a special offering? What if this wasn't like on the top? What if we gave away everything? Because I really do believe it's better to give than receive. So what if one Sunday in December, we just gave away the entire offering to missions? And I didn't know how that would go. And I want to tell you, I was a little nervous about it. Because to give away an offering, that means that we don't have the money to pay our bills, and we don't have the money that week to like pay our rent and to pay our staff. So we were just trusting that God was going to provide, that He was going to be generous to us if we were generous. And so we just threw this idea out there. And last December, as a church that wasn't even a year old, for that one-time offering, we raised almost $7,000 to give to missions. Now, I was blown away by that. That was like a modern-day miracle for me. But I didn't know it was a miracle to other churches until about 6 months later, the organization sent us a certificate that said we were one of the top-tier giving churches in America. And we were up against churches that have 1,000 people, 2,000 people, 3,000 people, 5,000 people, and we were giving what they did not give. That's a miracle. Now, I tell you all that not to pat ourselves on the back or not so that you think that we're awesome. I just tell you that because I really do think God is doing amazing things in our church. And I think most of you think that God is doing amazing things in our church. But if you do not start investing in someone that does not know God, eventually you will go negative at the place where God has you. I promise you. You may love what's going on now, but if you do not start investing and pouring salt into someone else, eventually you'll start saying, man, Rob used to be a lot more funnier back in the old days. Man, I used to like worship a lot better. How come they do so many songs with woes in it? You should start saying things like, man, I don't like the color of the new T-shirt. Man, it was too hot in our church last night. That's awful. You'll start complaining about things that do not matter. And I say this not because I've heard you complain. I say this from years of church experience, that if you do not pour out into someone else, you will lose sight of the mission. You will turn inward, and you will start crucifying each other. You'll start complaining. And I want to tell you, if it's not this church, if God moves you somewhere else, it'll happen at that church. You'll have a warm, fuzzy feeling for 6 months to a year, and eventually you'll start nitpicking at everything they do if you do not start pouring out into other people. It just happens. So what do we do about it? Well, I want to tell you what I do with my kids. My kids, I have twins. They're 2.5 years old. And 2.5-year-olds have some great days and they have some awful days. And there are some awful days where my daughter or my son will just cry and complain about everything, things that don't matter. This week, it's been Cookie Monster. We've had this Cookie Monster that they haven't cared about for forever. And now they've rediscovered it, and the Cookie Monster is kind of cool. He comes to life, and you put cookies in his mouth, and they come out in a backpack, and he talks to you, and he's like, cowabunga. And if my son gets Cookie Monster before my daughter, her world falls apart. It's not just like, oh, I wish I could have it. Ah, Daddy! And she's like crying, and I try to point to her and say, no, honey, look, you've got all these other toys. They're fun to play with. Let's play with this one. Look, it's really cool. And she's like, no, I want Cookie Monster! She starts complaining about something that doesn't even matter in this world. So what do? I find anything that can distract her. Literally. There have been times when I've tried to give her all these toys and she just doesn't want it. And so I look out the window and I see a squirrel and I say, Reese, look, a squirrel. And I know some of you are thinking that that is just instilling in her early ADD, but I've got to do what I got to do. And she'll look out and she's like, oh, squirrel. And then she's no longer focused on the Cookie Monster. And some of you need to refocus on the mission, on what we're supposed to do. You need to stop looking at the nitpicking things and saying, oh, I don't like this. Oh, my last church did it this way. Oh, we're not good enough. Why do we do this? Blah, blah, blah. Negative, negative, negative. You need to stop going negative and you need to start focusing on the mission. Because when you're focused on the mission of actually reaching people, you don't have time to complain. Oh, look, a squirrel. I got something important to do. I got to go out here and be salt to the earth. So I want to give you guys some applications, some things that you can do. Two things. Number one, pray for opportunities to share Jesus. This is how you apply this message today. Some of you are here today and you would say that you just don't have any non-Christian friends. Your life is just filled with Christians. And if that's you, pray and ask God that He would give you someone. Pray and ask for opportunities to share Jesus and watch what God does. Number two, share Jesus. Simply share Jesus in your conversations, in your Facebook posts. That doesn't mean you have to be cheesy Christian and bring Jesus into everything. It doesn't mean you have to slap someone in the store when they say happy holidays and say, no, it's Merry Christmas. That doesn't mean you have to become this jerk. It just means that you need to be bringing God flavors into the earth. Share God's love with people. Share Jesus. And one last thing as we close, I know that some of you hear that and you would say, okay, I get it, but I'm just scared. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to say it. I don't know how to tell someone about Jesus. We need a class. Rob, can you give us a class on how to tell our friends about Jesus? And I would say, hey, classes are great, but I don't think it's fair that you would treat the greatest gift differently than you treat other gifts in your life. Because never once in your life, before you posted on Facebook or before you told your friends about other great gifts, did you say, I have to have a class to understand this gift. You just told people about it. For me, in the 80s, one of the greatest gifts that I got was the Nintendo, the original Nintendo. It was made in Japan. I don't speak Japanese. In fact, if my friends who came over to play my Nintendo asked me, what does Nintendo mean? I'd be like, I don't know. Just play. Shut up. Let's play. If my friends tried to get me to explain how the Nintendo works, I would say, look, all I know is it has amazing 8-bit graphics. Well, what's a bit? I don't know. Just play. How does all the stuff end? I don't know. I don't know how it works. I don't understand how sometimes you'd put the game in the console and you hit power and it wouldn't work. And I don't understand how everyone knew the way to fix that is you hit power again, you take the game out, and you go, and you put it back in the console and it works. I don't have a fat clue how that works. I've never taken a class on it. I don't understand everything about the Nintendo. All I did was love the Nintendo, and I invited people to love it with me. And it's the exact same thing with a relationship with Jesus. You love Jesus. No one should be teaching you or forcing you how to tell people about Him. It just comes out. And you're like, dude, this is a great experience. Just experience Jesus with me. It'll change your life. You are the salt of the earth. So this Christmas season, let's be salty. Will you pray with me? God, thanks for this day. Thank you for your love for us. Thank you that you give us grace. And God, you remind us sometimes that we do need to share the greatest gift. I pray, God, that you would stir something in here, that we would be thinking about friends and family members that don't know you. That, God, we wouldn't let fear of not knowing all the answers stop us from sharing the greatest gift with those that we love. God, I pray that you would bring divine appointments this week, that we would run into people that want to hear our story, that we'd run into people that would see something different in us. I pray, God, that this would not cause us to want to fake perfection, but that we would be more authentic, that we would be more real, that we would say, I don't know, and we don't have an answer, but we would still share our love for you. Give us the courage to go out and shine. Give us the courage to change the world for you. In Jesus' name, amen.